This is Audible.
The Sign of the Beaver by Elizabeth George Speer. Chapter 1. Matt stood at the edge of the clearing for some time after his father had gone out of sight among the trees. There was just a chance that his father might turn back, that perhaps he had forgotten something or had some last word of advice. This was one time Matt reckoned he wouldn't mind the advice, no matter how many times he had heard it before. But finally, he had to admit that this was not going to happen. His father had really gone. He was alone, with miles of wilderness stretching on every side. He turned and looked back at the log house. It was a fair house, he thought. His mother would have no cause to be ashamed of it. He had helped to build every inch of it. He had helped to cut down the spruce trees and haul the logs and square and notch them. He had stood at one end of every log and raised it, one on top of the other, fitting the notched ends together as snugly as though they had grown that way. He had climbed the roof to fasten down the cedar splints with long poles and dragged up pine boughs to cover them. Behind the cabin were the mounds of corn he had helped to plant, the green blades already shooting up, and the pumpkin vines just showing between the stumps of trees. If only it were not so quiet. He had been alone before. His father had often gone into the forest to hunt, for hours on end. Even when he was there, he was not much of a talker. Sometimes they had worked side by side through a whole morning without his speaking a single word. But this silence was different. It coiled around Matt and reached into his stomach to settle there in a hard knot. He knew it was high time his father was starting back. This was part of the plan that the family had worked out together in the long winter of 1768, sitting by lamplight around the pine table back in Massachusetts. His father had spread out the surveyor's map and traced the boundaries of the land he had purchased in Maine Territory. They would be the first settlers in a new township. In the spring, when the ice melted, Matt and his father would travel north. They would take passage on a ship to the settlement at the mouth of the Penobscot River. There they would find some man with a boat to take them up the river, and then on up a smaller river that branched off from it, many days' distance from the settlement. Finally, they would strike out on foot into the forest and claim their own plot of land. They would clear a patch of ground, build a cabin, and plant some corn. In the summer, his father would go back to Massachusetts to fetch his mother and sister and the new baby, who would be born while they were gone. Matt would stay behind and guard the cabin and the corn patch. It hadn't been quite so easy as it had sounded back in their house in Quincy. Matt had had to get used to going to sleep at night with every muscle in his body aching. But the log house was finished. It had only one room. Before winter, they would add a loft for him and his sister to sleep in. Inside, there were shelves along one wall and a sturdy puncheon table with two stools. One of these days, his father promised, he would cut out a window and fasten oiled paper to let in the light. Someday, the paper would be replaced with real glass. Against the wall was a chimney of smaller logs, daubed and lined with clay from the creek. This, too, was a temporary structure. Over and over, his father had warned Matt that it wasn't as safe as a stone chimney, and that he had to watch out for flying sparks. He needn't fear. After all the work of building this house, Matt wasn't going to let it burn down about his ears. 6 weeks, his father had said that morning. Maybe seven. Hard to reckon exactly. With your ma and sister, we'll have slow going, especially with the new little one. You may lose track of the weeks, he had added. Easy thing to do when you're alone. Might be well to make notches on a stick. 7 notches to a stick. When you get to the 7th stick, you can start looking for us. Silly thing to do, Matt thought, as though he couldn't count the weeks for himself. But he wouldn't argue about it, not on the last morning. Then his father reached up to a chink in the log wall and took down the battered tin box that held his watch and his compass and a few silver coins. He took out the big silver watch. Every time you cut a notch, he said, remember to wind this up at the same time. Matt took the watch in his hand as gently as if it were a bird's egg. "You aim to leave it, Pa?" he asked. "It belonged to your grandpa. Would have belonged to you anyhow, sooner or later. Might as well be now."
"You mean it's mine?"
"Aye, it's yourn. Be kind of company, hearing it tick." The lump in Matt's throat felt as big as the watch. This was the finest thing his father had ever possessed.
"I'll take care of it," he managed finally.
I knowed you would. Mind you don't wind it up too tight."
Then, just before he left, his father had given him a second gift. Thinking of it, Matt walked back into the cabin and looked up at his father's rifle, hanging on two pegs over the door. "I'll take your old blunderbuss with me," his father had said. "This one aims truer. But mind you, don't go banging away at everything that moves. Wait till you're dead sure. There's plenty of powder if you don't waste it." It was the first sign he had given that he felt uneasy about leaving Matt here alone. Matt wished now that he could have said something to reassure his father, instead of standing there tongue-tied. But if he had the chance again, he knew he wouldn't do any better. They just weren't a family to put things into words. He reached up and took down the rifle. It was lighter than his old matchlock, the one his father had carried away with him in exchange. This was a fine piece. The walnut stock as smooth and shining as his mother's silk dress. It was a mite long, but it had a good balance. With his gun, he wouldn't need to waste powder, so it wouldn't hurt to take one shot right now, just to try the feel of it. He knew his father always kept that rifle as clean as a new polished spoon, but because he enjoyed handling it, Matt poked about in the touch hole with a metal pick. From the powder horn, he shook a little of the black powder into the pan. Then he took one lead bullet out of the pouch, wrapped it in a patch of cloth, and rammed it into the barrel. As he worked, he whistled loudly into the stillness. It made the knot in his stomach loosen a little. As he stepped into the woods, a blue jay screeched a warning. So it was some time before he spotted anything to shoot at. Presently, he saw a red squirrel hunched on a branch, with its tail curled up behind its ears. He lifted the rifle and sighted along the barrel, minding his father's advice and waiting till he was dead sure. The clean feel of the shot delighted him. It didn't set him back on his heels like his old matchlock. Still, he hadn't quite got the knack of it. He caught the flick of a tail as the squirrel scampered to an upper branch. "I could do better with my own gun," he thought. This rifle of his father's was going to take some getting used to. Ruefully, he trudged back to the cabin. For his noon meal, he sat munching a bit of the Johnny cake his father had baked that morning. Already, he was beginning to realize that time was going to move slowly. A whole afternoon to go before he could cut that first notch. 7 sticks. That would be August. He would have a birthday before August. He supposed his father had forgotten that, with so many things on his mind. By the time his family got here, he would be 13 years old. Chapter 2. By the next morning, the tight place in his stomach was gone. By the morning after that, Matt decided that it was mighty pleasant living alone. He enjoyed waking to a day stretched before him to fill as he pleased. He could set himself the necessary chores without having to listen to any advice about how they should be done. How could he have thought that the time would move slowly? As the days passed and he cut one notch after another on his stick, Matt discovered that there was never time enough for all that must be done between sunrise and sunset. Although the cabin was finished, his father had left him the endless task of chinking the spaces between the logs with clay from the creek bank. At the edge of the clearing, there were trees to fell to let in more sun on the growing corn, and underbrush that kept creeping closer over the cleared ground. All this provided plenty of wood to be chopped and stacked in the woodpile against the cabin wall. To cook a meal for himself once or twice a day, he had to keep a fire going. Twice in the first few days, he had waked and found the ashes cold. Back home in Quincy, if his mother's fire burned out, she had sent him or Sarah with her shovel to borrow a live coal from a neighbor. There was no neighbor here. He had to gather twigs and make a wad of shredded cedar bark, then strike his flint and blow on the tiny spark until it burst into flame. A man could get mighty hungry before he had coaxed that spark into a cooking fire. The corn patch needed constant tending. In these hot, bright days, every drop of water that those green shoots demanded had to be lugged from the creek, a kettleful at a time, and there was no way to water the corn without encouraging the weeds as well. As fast as he pulled them, new ones sprang up. The crows drove him distracted, forever flapping about. A dozen times a day he would dash at them fiercely, shouting and waving his arms. They would just fly lazily off and wait on a nearby treetop till his back was turned. He dared not waste his precious powder on them. At night, wild creatures nibbled the tops of the green shoots. Once he sat up all night with his rifle across his knees, batting at the mosquitoes. When morning came, he stumbled into the cabin and slept away half the day. That was the second time he let the fire go out. He seemed to be hungrier than ever before in his life. The barrel of flour was going down almost as fast as when two were dipping into it. He depended on his gun to keep his stomach filled. He was still proud of that gun, but no longer in awe of it. Carrying it over his shoulder, he set out confidently into the forest, venturing farther each day, certain of bringing home a duck or a rabbit for his dinner. For a change of diet, he could take his fish pole and follow the twisting course of the creek, or walk the trail his father had blazed to a pond some distance away. In no time, he could catch all the fish he could eat. Twice he had glimpsed a deer moving through the trees just out of range of his rifle. One of these days, he promised himself, he would bring one down. It was a good life, with only a few small annoyances buzzing like mosquitoes inside his head. One of these was the thought of Indians. Not that he feared them. His father had been assured by the proprietors that his new settlement would be safe. Since the last treaty with the tribes, there had not been an attack reported anywhere in this part of Maine. Still, one could not entirely forget all those horrid tales. And he just didn't like the feeling he had sometimes that someone was watching him. He couldn't prove it. He could never see anything more than a quick shadow that might be a moving branch, but he couldn't shake off the feeling that someone was there. One of those pieces of advice his father had been so fond of giving him had been about Indians. "They won't bother you," he said. "Most of them have left for Canada. The ones who stayed don't want to make any trouble. But Indians take great stock in politeness. Should you meet one, speak to him just the same as to the minister back home." Matt had seen his father follow his own advice. Once, when they had tramped a long way from the cabin, they had seen in the distance a solitary dark-skinned figure. The two men had nodded to each other gravely and lifted a hand in salute, exactly as if they had been two deacons passing in the town square. But how could you be respectful to a shadow that would not show itself? It made Matt uneasy. He had grown used to the stillness. In fact, he knew now that the forest is rarely quiet. As he tramped through it, he was accompanied by the chirruping of birds, the chatter of squirrels, and the whine and twang of thousands of bothersome insects. In the night, he could recognize now the strange sounds that used to startle him, the grunt of a porcupine rummaging in the garden, the boom of the great horned owl, the scream of some small creature pounced upon in the forest, or the long, quavering cry of the loon from the distant pond. The first time he'd heard that loon call, he had thought it was a wolf. Now he liked to hear it. Mournful as it was the cry of another living creature. Matt would worm his shoulder into a comfortable spot in the hemlock boughs that made his mattress, pull the blanket over his head to shut out the mosquitoes, and fall asleep well satisfied with his world. He would have liked, however, to have someone to talk to occasionally. He hadn't reckoned on missing that. For much of the day, he was content to be alone, tramping through the woods or sitting on the bank of the creek, dangling his fish line. He was like his father in that. But there were times when he had a thought he'd like to share with someone, with anybody, even his sister, Sarah, though he'd never paid much mind to her at home. So he was not so quick-witted as he should have been when unexpectedly someone arrived. Chapter 3. He was sitting on the flat stone that served as a doorstep, waiting for his supper to cook. The late sun slanted in long yellow bars across the clearing. The forest beyond was already in shadow. Matt was feeling well pleased with his day. That morning he had shot a rabbit. He had skinned it carefully, stretching the fur against the cabin wall to dry. Chunks of the meat were boiling now in the kettle over the fire, and the good smell came through the door and made his mouth water. In the dimness of the trees, a darker shadow moved. This time it didn't disappear, but came steadily nearer. He could hear the crackle of twigs under heavy boots. Matt leaped to his feet. "Pa!" No answer. It wasn't his father, of course. It couldn't be. An Indian? Matt felt a curl of alarm against his backbone. He stood waiting, his muscles tensed. The man who came tramping out from the trees was not an Indian. He was heavy set, the fat bulging under a ragged blue army coat. His face was almost invisible behind a tangle of reddish whiskers. Halfway across the clearing, he stopped. "Howdy," he called cheerfully. "Hello?" Matt answered uncertainly. Was this someone who ought to be greeted like a deacon? The stranger came closer, so that Matt could see the small blue eyes that glittered in the weather-hardened face. The man stood, deliberately taking his time, looking over the cabin and the cornfield. "Nice place you got here." Matt said nothing. The man peered curiously over Matt's shoulder through the open door. He could easily see that the cabin was empty. "You all alone here?" Matt hesitated. "My father is away just now." "Be back soon, will he?" Matt was puzzled by his own unwillingness to answer. He ought to be glad to see anyone after all these days alone, but somehow he wasn't. He didn't quite know why he found himself lying. "Any time now," he said. "He went back to the river to get supplies. He might be back tonight. When I saw you coming, I thought it was him." "Guess I surprised you. Reckon you don't get much company way off here." "No, we don't," Matt answered.
"Then your pappy wouldn't want you to turn away a visitor, would he?"
the man asked.
"Thought maybe you'd ask me to stay for supper. I got a whiff of it half a mile off."
Matt remembered his manners. The man's easy grin was beginning to wipe away some of his doubts. "Of course," he said. "Come in, sir."
The man snorted. "Ben's the name," he said. "You may have heard of me in the river town."
"We didn't stay in the town very long," Matt answered. He hurried now to light a candle. The stranger stood inside the door, taking in every inch of the small room.
"Your pappy knows how to build a good, tight house," he said. "You reckon on staying here for good?"
"It's our land," Matt told him. In the candlelight, the room looked snug and homey, something to be proud of showing off to a stranger. "My mother and sister will be coming soon."
"More folks coming all the time," man said. "Time was you could tramp for a month and never see a chimney. Now the towns are spreading out from the river every which way."
His eye fell on the rifle hanging over the door. He let out a slow, admiring whistle and walked over to run his hand along the stock.
"Mighty fine piece," he said. "Worth a passel of beaver."
"My father wouldn't sell it," Matt said shortly. He was busying himself now to make this stranger welcome. He scooped out a good measure of flour, stirred in some water, patted the dough out on a clean ashboard, and propped it up in front of the fire to bake. He laid out the two bowls on the table and the two pewter spoons. He poured molasses into the one pewter dish. Then he ladled the hot stew into the bowls.
"The way that stew disappeared, the stranger couldn't have eaten a meal for a good while."
Matt took a very small share for himself. He pulled back his hand and watched the man snatch the last bit of corn cake, sopping up the last of the molasses with it. Finally, Ben pushed back his stool and drew the back of his hand across his beard.
"That was mighty tasty, son, mighty tasty. You wouldn't have a mite of tobacco now, would you?"
"I'm sorry," Matt said. "My father doesn't have any."
"Pity. Can't be helped, I suppose."
In the easy silence that followed, Matt decided to ask a question of his own. "Are you traveling to the river?"
Ben snorted again. "Not likely. I'm keeping as far off from that river as I can, till things quiet down."
Matt waited.
"Tell the truth, I got away from that town just in time. Weren't nothing they could prove, but they sure had it in for me. So I says, 'Ben,' I says, 'you been planning on getting yourself some beaver pelts? Looks like now's the time to get moving. I aim to settle in with the Redskins a bit. Maybe move on north.'
You mean you're going to live with the Indians?
Could do worse. I could bed down about anywheres.
It certainly looked as though, invited or not, Ben was planning on bedding down right here in the cabin. He had eased himself off the stool and sprawled out on the floor, his shoulders propped against the wall. He pulled a dirty corncob pipe from his pocket and stared down at it ruefully.
Pity, he said again. Meal like that needs baccy to settle it right.
He put the pipe away and shifted his heavy bulk against the wall.
When I was not much more'n your age, he drawled, well-fed and ready to talk, I'd spend the whole winter with the Redskins, hunt with them, trap, easy to pick up their lingo, still remember a deal of it. But this country ain't the same anymore. You gotta go west. Ohio, maybe, to get any decent trapping.
The Indians still hunt here, don't they? Matt asked.
The Indians has mostly cleared out of these parts, Ben told him. What wasn't killed off in the war got took with the sickness. A deal of them moved on to Canada. What's left makes a mighty poor living, game getting so scarce.
Where do they live?
Roundabout, Ben waved vaguely toward the forest. They make small camps for a while and then move on. The Penobscots stick like burrs, won't give up. They still hunt and trap, no way to stop them. Never got it through their heads they don't still own this land.
You never seen none of them?
My father did once.
Do they speak English?
Enough to get what they want. They pick it up from the traders. What pelts they can scrape together, they take into the towns. They can strike a sharp deal. You gotta know how to handle them.
Reason you ain't seen them, he went on. They got enough sense to clear out of these parts when the bugs is bad. They move off, the whole lot, down to the coast to get their year's mess of clams. Should be moving back about now. They'll stay the summer and then go off for the big hunt come fall.
Them hunts, he remembered. Ain't nothing like 'em nowadays. Bows and arrows was all they had. Still use 'em some, if they can't lay hands on a gun. I got so's I was damn near as good as any of 'em. Don't suppose I could hit a barn door now.
Ben's voice drawled on and on, thickened with food and drowsiness. He told of the big moose hunts of his days with the Indians. He had fought in the recent war against the French, and he despised them for stirring up the Indians against the main settlements. He seemed to have single-handedly shot down half the French army.
Especially he hated the Jesuit priests who had egged the Redskins on, and he had once been part of an expedition that broke into a chapel and smashed the popish idols. Once he had been taken captive by the fierce Iroquois, who were setting on putting him to torture, but he had been too smart for them and escaped in the night. Listening, Matt couldn't make the man out. To hear him talk, he had been as big a hero as Jack the Giant Killer. But he didn't look the part. He had certainly fallen on hard times of late. No doubt about it, however, he could tell a good story. The man's voice was trailing off, and he slumped lower and lower. Presently, he was sprawled flat on the floor and snoring. It was clear enough that he could bed down anywhere. At least he hadn't taken over Matt's bed. Matt moved quietly, though he doubted anything could disturb his guest. He cleaned off the bowls with his twig brush. Then he banked the fire with ashes. Finally, he settled down on his hemlock mattress. But he couldn't sleep. He lay staring up at the log roof, even after the last flickers of firelight had died away and the cabin was in darkness. He couldn't quiet his uneasy thoughts. Bragging about his adventures by the fire, Ben had seemed harmless, just a fat, tired old man grateful for a good meal. To be honest, Matt had enjoyed his company. Now he began to worry. How long was Ben going to stay? He was sure to find out soon that Matt was living alone. When he did, would he decide it was more comfortable here than in an Indian village? At the rate he had wolfed down that supper, the flour and molasses wouldn't hold out long. Would he expect Matt to go on providing meals and waiting on him? And why had he left that town on the river in such a hurry? Was there really some charge against him? Was he dangerous? Perhaps even a murderer? At the thought, Matt sat up on his pine bed. He'd be sensible to stay awake and on guard. He'd half a mind to fetch down his father's rifle and keep it near at hand. Then he felt ashamed. What would his father say about begrudging a stranger a meal and a night's rest? All the same,
He was determined not to shut his eyes that night. He kept them open for a long time, but suddenly he jerked out of a deep sleep and saw that daylight was streaming across the cabin floor. The cabin door was open, and the man was gone. Perhaps he had only stepped outside. Matt stumbled to the door. No sign of the stranger. Relief flooded over him. All that worrying, and the man had never intended to stay. Perhaps he had actually believed the lie that his father was returning that day. Then once again, Matt felt ashamed. He must have made it only too plain that Ben wasn't welcome. Would Pa say he had done wrong? Still, it was too early to be sure. At any moment, Ben might appear, hungry for breakfast. He had better stir up some fresh corn cake. It was then that he noticed. His father's rifle was not hanging over the door. In a panic, he searched the cabin, his own bed, the corner shelves, under the table and the stools. He rushed back to the door and on to the edge of the forest. It was no use. No way of telling which way the man had taken or how long he had been on his way while Matt slept. Ben was gone, and so was the rifle. He should have kept it in his hands, as his hunch had warned him. He could see now that the man had had his mind set on that gun from the moment he laid eyes on it. But even if Matt had had it in his hands, could he have held out against those burly arms? And to keep his gun, could he actually have shot a man? Even a criminal? It was only later, when his rage began to die down, that he felt a prickle of fear. Now he had no protection, and no way to get meat. Sick with anger, he sat staring at his row of notched sticks. It would be a month at least before his father returned. A month of nothing but fish. And what would his father say? Chapter 4. It was hard to be deprived of the hunting. Now, whenever he went into the forest, the squirrels and the rabbits frisked about boldly, knowing perfectly well he had no gun in his hands. Once, he was certain he could have had a good shot at a deer. Instead, he went fishing, and he knew he ought to be grateful that the creek and the pond could provide all the food he needed, even though fish didn't seem to stick to his ribs like a good meat stew. Here and there in a sunny spot, he discovered a patch of blueberries. Gradually, his spirits rose again. The July weather was perfect. The flies and mosquitoes were less bothersome. He began to count the days ahead instead of the ones he had notched. Two or three more sticks and his family would be here. The corn was growing taller. The little hard green pumpkins were rounding out. He could wait a little longer. Perhaps he even became a mite careless. He had been fishing all one morning. A good, clear day, the water still nippy on his ankles, the sun warm on his bare head. He had followed the creek a long way and had a lucky catch. He came whistling out of the woods, swinging four speckled trout. He quieted down of a sudden when he heard a crackling in the underbrush close by. Then he stopped short at sight of the cabin. The door was swinging open at a crazy angle, one hinge broken. Across the doorsill, some white stuff dribbled, like spilled flour. With a shout, he dropped the fish and ran. It was flour, tracked all over the cabin floor, the sack ripped open and dragged across the room. The cabin was a shambles, the stools overturned, the shelf swept bare, the precious molasses keg upside down on the floor and empty. Ben must have come back. For a moment, hot sparks of anger drove every sensible thought out of his head. Then he knew it couldn't have been Ben. Ben was too fond of food to waste it. Indians? No, it wasn't possible any human being would scatter food about like this. With a sinking heart, he realized what had happened. He remembered the thrashing in the underbrush. It had to be a bear. Somehow, he had neglected to bar the door securely. Well, the damage was done, and the bear would be half a mile away by now. Helpless with fury at his own carelessness, he stood for some time in the middle of the cabin, unable to pull his wits together. Then he went down on his hands and knees and carefully began to scrape up the traces of flour. After a time, he gave up. The best he had managed to salvage was two handfuls of gritty, unappetizing meal, even though he took the good pewter spoon and dug into the hollows of the dirt floor. After a long time, he felt hungry enough to remember the fish. Half-heartedly, he cleaned them and blew up the fire and roasted them. He found a few grains of salt left in the tin to sprinkle on them. He would have to make the best of it. He wouldn't starve as long as he had a fish line, but tomorrow he would not even have salt. Chapter 5. Day after day, he kept remembering the bee tree. He and his father had discovered it weeks ago. High in a tree, at the swampy edge of the pond they had called Loon Pond, the bees were buzzing in and out of an old woodpecker hole. Matt had thought they were wild bees, but his father said no. There were no bees at all in America till the colonists brought them from England. This swarm must have escaped from one of the river towns. Bees were better left alone, Pa said. He felt he could scarcely endure another meal of plain fish. He was hungry for a bit of something tasty. Knowing so well his fondness for molasses, his mother had persuaded them to carry that little keg all the way to Maine, when his father would rather have gone without. She would have smiled to see him running his finger round and round the empty keg like a child and licking off the last drop the bear had missed. Now he couldn't stop thinking about that honey. It would be worth a sting or two just to have a taste of it. There couldn't be much danger in going up that tree and taking just a little, a cupful perhaps, that the bees would never miss. One morning he made up his mind to try it, come what might. It was an easy tree to climb, with branches as neatly placed as the rungs of a ladder. The bees did not seem to notice as he pulled himself higher and higher. Even when his head was on a level with the hole, they flew lazily in and out, not paying him any mind. The hole was small, not big enough for his hand and the spoon he had brought with him. Peering in, he could just glimpse far inside the golden mass of honeycomb. The bark all around the hole was rotted and crumbling. Cautiously, he put his fingers on the edge and gave a slight tug. A good-sized piece of bark broke off into his hand. With it came the bees. With a furious buzzing, they came pouring from the broken hole. The humming grew to a roar, like a great wind. Matt felt a sharp pain on his neck, then another, and another. The angry creature swarmed along his hands and bare arms, in his hair, on his face. How he got down out of that tree, he never remembered. Water. If he could reach water, he could escape them. Bellowing and waving his arms, he plunged toward the pond. The bees were all around him. He could not see through the whirling cloud of them. The boggy ground sucked at his feet. He pulled one foot clear out of his boot, went stumbling over sharp roots to the water's edge, and flung himself forward. His foot caught in a fallen branch, and he wrenched it clear. Dazed with pain, he sank down into the icy shelter of the water. He came up choking. Just above the water, the angry bees circled. Twice more, he ducked his head and held it down till his lungs were bursting. He tried to swim out into the pond, but his feet were tangled in dragging weeds. When he tried to jerk them free, a fierce pain ran up his leg and he went under again, thrashing his arms wildly. Then something lifted him. His head came up from the water and he gulped air into his aching lungs. He felt strong arms around him. Half conscious, he dreamt that his father was carrying him, and he did not wonder how this could be. Presently, he knew he was lying on dry ground. Though his eyelids were swollen almost shut, he could see two figures bending over him, unreal, half-naked figures with dark faces. Then, as his wits began to return to him, he saw that they were Indians, an old man and a boy. The man's hands were reaching for his throat, and in panic, Matt tried to jerk away.
"Not move," a deep voice ordered. "Bee needles have poison. Must get out."
Matt was too weak to struggle. He could not even lift his head. Now that he was out of the cold water, his skin seemed to be on fire from head to toe, yet he could not stop shivering. He had to lie helpless while the man's hands moved over his face and neck and body. Gradually, he realized that they were gentle hands, probing and rubbing at one tender spot after another. His panic began to die away. He could still not think clearly. Things seemed to keep fading before he could quite grasp them. He could not protest when the man lifted him again and carried him like a baby. It did not seem to matter where they were taking him, but shortly he found himself lying on his own bed in his own cabin. He was alone. The Indians had gone. He lay, too tired and sore to figure out how he came to be there, knowing only that the nightmare of whirling bees and choking water was past and that he was safe. Some time passed. Then once again the Indian was bending over him, holding a wooden spoon against his lips. He swallowed in spite of himself, even when he found it was not food, but some bitter medicine. he was left alone again, and presently he slept. Chapter 6. Finally, Matt woke and knew that he was well. His body was no longer on fire. He could open his eyes, and he saw that sunlight glinted through the chinks in the roof. All his familiar things were around him, the shelves with the pewter dishes, his jacket hanging on a peg. He felt as though he had been on a long journey and had come home. He must have slept through half a day and a night. When the cabin door opened and the Indian entered, Matt hastily pulled himself up. Now, with clear eyes, he saw that there was nothing in the least strange about this man. He was dressed not so differently from Matt's own father, in a coat of some rough brown cloth and leggings fringed down the side. His face was smooth-shaven, and so was his whole head, except for one long black topknot. When he saw that Matt was awake, his stern face was lighted by a wide smile.
"Good." It was half word, half grunt. "White boy very sick. Now well."
Matt remembered his father's advice. "Good morning," he said respectfully. The Indian pointed a hand at his own chest.
"Sacnis, family of beaver," he said.
He seemed to be waiting. "I'm Matthew Hallowell," Matt answered.
"Good. White man leave you here?"
"Just for a while," Matt told him. "He has gone to get my mother." It did not occur to him to lie to this old man as he had to Ben. Moreover, he knew that there was something he had to say. He tried to find the right words. "I'm grateful to you," he said finally. "It was a very lucky thing you happened to find me."
"We watch. White boy very foolish to climb bee tree."
So, he had been right, Matt thought, that eyes were watching him from the forest. He was sure that the Indian had not asked him where he lived. They had brought him straight home to this cabin. Even though he knew it was his good fortune they'd been watching him yesterday, he still felt somewhat resentful of their spying. Abruptly, he swung his feet to the floor and winced as a sharp pain ran up his leg. The Indian noticed, and moving closer, he took Matt's ankle between his hands and pressed gently with his fingers. "Is it broken?" Matt asked.
"Nada. Not broke. Mend soon. Sleep now. Not need medicine more."
The Indian had put something on the table as he came in. When he had gone, Matt hobbled over to see what it was and found a wooden bowl of stew, thick and greasy, flavored with some strange plant, wonderfully filling and strengthening. With it there was a cake of cornbread, coarser than his own, but delicious. The next day, the Indian brought the boy with him.
"Nkwanis, you call grandson," he announced. "Atian."
The two boys stared at each other. The Indian boy's black eyes held no expression whatever. Unlike the old man, he was naked except for a breechcloth held up by a string at his waist. It passed between his legs and hung down like a little apron back and front. His heavy black hair fell straight to his shoulders.
"Atian, same winter as white boy, maybe?" the man asked. He held up 10 fingers, and then 4 more.
"I'm 13, Matt answered, holding up his own fingers. "At least," he excused himself, "that would be true in another week." The Indian boy did not speak a word. Quite plainly, he had been brought here against his will. He stared about the cabin and seemed to despise everything he saw. He made Matt feel like a fool, sitting with his leg propped up on a stool. Matt steadied himself on his good leg and stood up. Now he noticed that Sacnis was holding out to him a rough sort of crutch. Matt wished he did not have to try it right now, with both of them watching him, but he could see that the man expected it. He managed a few steps, furious at his own clumsiness. He had never imagined how pesky a crutch could be. Moreover, although there was not the slightest change in the boy's face, Matt was sure that Atian was laughing at him. There was a nasty little gleam in the boy's eyes. The moment they were gone, he seized the crutch in earnest, and very soon he could swing himself along at a good, brisk pace. Now he was able to get about outside the cabin, to check the corn patch, and bring in firewood. The trouble was, he had only one boot. The woolen stocking his mother had knit for him was wearing thin. On the rough ground, it wore through in no time. This, too, the Indian noticed when he came with his grandson next morning.
"No boot," he said, pointing.
"I lost it," Matt answered. "It came off in the mud when I ran." Once again, he felt ridiculous under the Indian boy's black stare. 3 days later, Sockneys brought him a pair of moccasins. They were handsome and new, of moose hide, dark and glistening with grease, tied with stout thongs that were long enough to wrap about his ankles.
"Beaver woman make," Sockneys said. "Better white man's boots. White boy see."
Matt took off his one boot and slipped on the moccasins. Indeed, they were better. In fact, they were wonderful. Not stiff like new leather boots. Not knobby or pinching anywhere. Light as nothing at all when he lifted his feet. No wonder Indians did not make a sound when they walked in the forest. Shame suddenly flooded over Matt. This man had perhaps saved his life, had come bringing food and a crutch, and now these beautiful moccasins. It wasn't enough just to say an awkward thank you. He needed to give something in return. Not money. There were a few silver coins in the tin box, but something made him very sure that he could not offer money to this proud old man. He looked about him in despair. There was almost nothing of his own in the cabin. Then he spied the two books on the shelf, the only two his father had been able to carry into the wilderness. One was the Bible. He dared not give away his father's Bible. The other book was his own, the only one he had ever possessed, Robinson Crusoe. He had read it a dozen times, and the thought of parting with it was painful, but it was the only thing he had to give. He hobbled across the room and took it down from the shelf and held it out to the Indian. Sockney stared at it. "It's for you," Matt said. "It's a gift. Please take it." Sockneys reached out and took the book in his hand. He turned it over and over slowly, his face showing not a sign of pleasure. Then he opened it and stood peering at the page. With shame, Matt saw that he was holding it upside down. He couldn't read. Of course he couldn't. Matt should have known that. He had made a terrible mistake and embarrassed the good man. He had heard once that the one thing an Indian could never forgive was a hurt to his pride. He felt his own face burning. But Sockneys did not look embarrassed. His dark stare went from the book to Matt's face. "White boy no signs?" he asked. Matt was puzzled. "White boy read what white man write here." "Yes," Matt admitted. "I can read it." For a long moment, the Indian studied the book. Then, astonishingly, that rare white smile flashed. "Good," he grunted. "Sockneys make treaty." "A treaty?" Matt was even more puzzled. "Inquanis hunt. Bring white boy bird and rabbit. White boy teach Atian white man signs." "You mean I should teach him to read?" "Good. White boy teach Atian what books say." Doubtfully, Matt looked from the old man to the boy, who stood silently listening. His heart sank. The scorn in the boy's face had turned to black anger.
"Nda!" The furious word exploded. The first word Matt had ever heard him speak.
Half under his breath, he muttered a string of incomprehensible words. His grandfather's stern face did not change. He was undisturbed by the boy's defiance. "Atian learn," he said. "White man come more and more to Indian land. White man not make treaty with pipe. White man make signs on paper, signs Indian not know. Indian put mark on paper to show him friend of white man. Then white man take land, tell Indian cannot hunt on land. Atian learn to read white man's signs. Atian not give away hunting grounds." The boy glowered at his grandfather, but he did not dare to speak again. With a black scowl, he stalked out of the cabin.
"Good," said Sockneys calmly. He handed the book back to Matt. "Atian come Saba. Tomorrow."
Chapter 7. Before he had his eyes open next morning, Matt knew that something was wrong with this day. When it came back to him, he sat up with a groan. Atian. What had possessed him to give a book to an Indian? How could he possibly teach a savage to read? He tried to think back to the time his mother had taught him his ABCs. He could plainly see that brown covered primer she held in her hands. He had detested it. He had had to learn the short verses printed beside each letter. A. In Adam's fall, we sinned all. That would hardly do. To be honest, he wasn't sure to this day just what it meant. He would feel mighty silly trying to explain it to a heathen. Then happily he recalled another book that had been sent to his sister, Sarah, from England, with a small picture to illustrate each letter. No nonsense about Adam. A was for apple. Sarah had been luckier than he. But he had no way of making pictures.
and there were no apples here in the forest. What could he find for A that an Indian would understand? He looked about the cabin. T for table, though it was unlikely they'd ever get as far as T. How about A for arm? That was simple enough. B. His eye fell on the leg bone of the squirrel left from last night's meal. The stub of a candle would do for C. D. Door would be just the word for Atian. He certainly could walk out of one fast enough, and would again, no doubt, long before they got to D. He doubted that Atian would come. Still, he had better be ready. He stirred the fire, ate a chunk of the cold Indian corn cake, and set about to prepare a schoolroom. He shoved the two stools together and laid Robinson Crusoe on the table. He did not have paper or ink. He found a ribbon of birch bark in a corner and tore off a strip and sharpened a stick to a point. Then he waited. Atian came, swinging a dead rabbit by the ears. He slung it disdainfully on the table. "Thank you," Matt said. "That's a big one. I won't need anything else for several days." His politeness brought no response. "Sit here," he ordered. He hesitated. "I never thought as how I'd have to teach anyone to read, but I have figured a way to start." Silently, the boy sat down, as straight and rigid as a cedar post. When Matt hunched himself onto the other stool, the boy's scowl deepened. Plainly, he did not like having the white boy so close to him. Atian had no need to be finicky, Matt thought. He smelled none too sweet himself. The grease smeared on his body, even on his hair, stunk up the whole cabin. It was supposed to keep off the mosquitoes, he'd heard, but he thought he'd rather have the pesky insects himself. He drew a letter on the birch bark. "This is the first letter," he explained. "A. A for arm." He repeated this several times, pointing to his own arm. Atian kept to his stubborn, scornful silence. Matt set his jaw. He could be stubborn, too, he decided. He opened Robinson Crusoe. "We'll pick out the A's on this page," he said, trying to control his impatience. He pointed. "Now you show me one." Atian stared straight ahead of him in silence. Then, to Matt's astonishment, he grudgingly laid a grubby finger on a letter A. "Good," said Matt, copying the word Sockneys used so often. "Find another." Suddenly the boy broke his silence. "White man's book foolish," he scoffed. "Write arm, arm, arm all over paper." Puzzled at first, Matt saw his own mistake. "Hundreds of other words begin with A," he explained, "or have A in them. And there are 25 more letters." Atian scowled. "How long?" he demanded. "What do you mean?" "How long Atian learned signs in book?" "It will take some time," Matt said. "There are a lot of long words in this book." "One moon?" "One moon."